Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. I'm going to begin in a perhaps initially surprising and unexpected place, looking back just a few days to the commemoration, marked by recitals of various kinds across the Muslim world, of the occasion of the Ascension, the Mi'raj. It's a traditional event which has historically, and to this day, continues to allow communities to reflect on a trans-historical moment, which in many ways is seen as the culmination of prophetic history. Described in many hadith reports and elaborated in sometimes rather baroque ways by thousands of poems and litanies in just about every Muslim language, the event has the man of praise praying in congregation with the earlier prophets in Jerusalem, and then taken up by Gabriel on a great ascent through the seven heavens into the divine presence. A number of symbolic events then occur. And I'd like to begin by reciting one text which summarizes much of the traditional teaching. The holy prophet perceives majestic oneness take formless form, clear as a full moon in the night sky, thus perceiving Allah as lovers of reality will perceive him in the highest dimensions of paradise. Essence communes with the beloved prophet in modes unimaginable, where neither word nor voice nor sign nor touch is needed. With divine tenderness far beyond even the prophet's enlightened expectation, the voice of truth resounds through his entire being. I am your secret heart, your true desire. I am your perfect refuge, your only love. I am the divine reality you worship. For me alone, O Muhammad of light, you have sighed unceasingly throughout the long journey of prophecy. You have secretly called out, why can I not directly behold the beauty of the essence of beauty? Come now, friend of all souls. The love I feel for you is beyond my love for the whole creation. All humanity is your humble servant. Whatever you desire from the infinite treasure house of divine power and blessing is yours for the asking. Thousandfold healing, thousandfold illumination, thousandfold love. Beloved messenger, your soul will never turn from the experience of this. Return now into temporality and invite humanity, the created expression of my essence, to come unto me to gaze at last upon the source of truth and beauty. Traveling beyond time and eternity, you have interceded for them all at the abode of essence. I grant to your community the daily prayers of Islam, which, when performed with purity of heart, will lift them into paradise while still on earth. Every level of heavenly experience is contained in the prayer. The prayer will lead them along the very way of ascension that I led you. End quote. The fundamental Muslim practice of the five daily prayers is thus believed to be a recollection of the prophetic ascension. Its basic postures of standing, bowing, prostrating, and sitting are said to be based on the worshipful forms of the angels whom the man of praise saw on his celestial journey. The Australian theologian Rod Blackhurst evinces this Quranic ethos in an essay on Muslim prayer. For Blackhurst, the prayer gifted at the ascension is a primordial enactment of humanity's status as bridge between heaven and earth. The prophetic follower worships in a fully embodied way, in a mind-body synergy particularly characteristic of Islam's sense of itself as the reclamation of a lost Abrahamic primordiality, al-Hanifiyyah. The entire Muslim life is shaped by forms of worship which engage the body and spirit with the movements of sun and moon, and hence represent the believer's full belongingness to the created order. Nonetheless, he is, like Adam, between water and clay, the water which is of heaven and the clay which is the stuff of which he is made. This Abrahamic cosmology depicts Adam as being of the fitra, the Quranic term which denotes nature and what is natural, not as fallen, but as a theophany made of grace and a reminder of God's presence as al-qarib, the near. The prayer is also a recollection of the salvation to be offered by the prophetic intercession, since the man of praise is directly addressed in the final invocation. The response prayer to the adhan likewise recalls the praiseworthy station, al-maqam al-mahmud, understood as the intercessory rite of the sealing Ishmaelite messenger. Hence, on the ship of salvation, the ark which carries the last Abrahamic community over the foaming seas of the eschatological age, the intercessor is not only the one who is saved, but the one whose example in this life and whose intercessory prayer in the next delivers others. Here the name of the ark's builder, Noah, is recalled. He is Najiullah in the Hadiths, the one saved by God, but he also prays to save others, who are a numberless host, Abrahamically, as many as the stars in the sky. In other ascension narrative, we encounter a second well-known incident, which also concerns salvation. Here, Gabriel comes to the man of praise and offers him two chalices, one of wine and another of milk. When he chooses the latter, Gabriel tells him, "You have been guided to the fitra, hudita lil fitra," a word often translated simply as nature. These hadiths and the luxuriant commentary literature which grew upon them are evidently constructed to make a defining point about the nature of this ship of faith. If we begin with the two chalices, we find, very probably, a polemic against Christian sacramentalism, understood in a particular way. The wine is not for the Prophet's people. Muslim commentators explaining this well-known Sharia negation claim that intoxication diminishes the imago Dei and hence commits an offence against God's purposes. Moralists predictably add information about alcohol's social effects. Alcohol is, in this sense, a symbol of the son who fails to board the ship and becomes the weapon and sign of his profane mastery over what remains of the world. Others will note that a polemical point about salvation is apparently being made as well. Wine is nature denatured, the fermentation being a sign of humanity's departure from what God has originally made. The milk, by contrast, is a useful and straightforward symbol of a pure nourishment unaltered by human plans, ego, or intervention. So you have been guided to nature, hudita lil fitra, is being constructed as an important structural principle in the newest Abrahamic dispensation. Let's consider another of Islam's founding stories about salvation, this time a seemingly much more earthly one. This is the religion's reparative recital of the story of Isaac and Ishmael. The latter, or their firstborn, was for the biblical authors the heir according to the flesh. Only the former, with his sacrifice understood by Christians as a Eucharistic anticipation, is claimed by pre-Muslim interpreters to be the heir in the spirit. A fierce and unyielding binary is thus introduced. Christian art frequently alluded to this by contrasting Ishmael's mother Hagar with the Virgin Mary. Rubens, for instance, in his depictions of the women, paints Mary in blue, the colour of heaven and virginal purity, while Hagar wears red, the colour of the flesh, eros, carnality. And medieval Christian polemics sometimes used the concupiscence represented by Hagar as a sign of Islam's falsity. Islam is a garden of nature. And here, in fact, we are not very far from the fitra apparently assumed by the ascension narratives. So fitra is in some way constructed as a kind of watchword of Islam and its soteriology, its theory of salvation. Islam is Deen al-Fitra, the fitra faith. The medieval commentator, At-Tabari, wrote that fitra is what differentiates Islam from the baptism of Christianity or the circumcision of Judaism. There is something covenantal and initiatory about it. All this seems to make sense against the backdrop of Islam's understanding of itself as the sealing or closing dispensation within the history of monotheism. Islam, as the unexpected Ishmaelite religion, the vindication of the outcast, is the third side of the great equilateral triangle. It is the third of the three visitors to Abraham beneath the oak at Mamre. And as the ascension narratives affirm, it seems to be linked not only to an Abrahamic restoration, and of course, the blessing of Abraham forms a key component of the canonical daily prayers, but to something more ancient, a natural form of religion, the religion of milk, of unmediated encounter with the divine in the substance of nature. This is possibly why the shrine of the Ascension, the Dome of the Rock, is constructed according to an octagonal plan. Octograms of overlapping squares are called in Islamic geometry Najmat al-Quds, the Jerusalem star. Eight-pointed stars and the octagons which are related to them are very ancient Near Eastern symbols, once even representing Ishtar, or Venus, as the evening star. The overlapping squares are understood as a reconciliation of dualities and complements, and hence of fertility. According to the Hutchinson Dictionary of Symbols, the shape is linked to creation, fertility, and sex. This is also the primary resonance of the crescent and star motif, which Islam came to adopt as its symbol, cyclical, selenic, fertile, nocturnal. The crescent again connects with Hajar and Ishmael, Abraham's family according to the flesh, who lie buried, of course, in the Hatim, the crescent-shaped enclosure beside the Kaaba in the great sanctuary. This theological awareness of Islam as a latter-day retrieval of a very primordial, pre-axial form of religion, the fitra, helps us to understand certain very recurrent themes of the Qur'an. The scripture presents the natural world as an array of divine theophanies, saying that wherever you turn, there is the face of God. The word for natural signs, ayat, is the same word used for scriptural verses. So as well as al-Qur'an al-Tadwini, the written Qur'an, there is al-Qur'an al-Takwini, the creation Qur'an, whose signs we are invited to read and which, like the written scripture, comprise a bodying forth of the effulgent divine breath. So the Qur'an says, this is Surah 41, verse 53, we shall show them our signs on the horizons and in their own souls until it becomes clear to them that it is the truth. Even more notably, we find a range of verses insisting that all things praise God. For instance, Surah 17, verse 44. There is no thing which does not glorify him with praise. And also 24, 41. Have you not seen that everything in the heavens and the earth and the birds in their arrays sing God's praise? Each one knows its prayer and its glorification, and God knows what they do. The seeming archaism of the Muslim scripture and the insistence on chanting in a natural cosmos which seems to be animated and alive inclined the philosopher Herder to describe Islam as a sort of shamanism. Schleiermacher, too, in considering the religious claims of Islam, also dismisses it as a shamanism. Here is an example of Schleiermacher's judgment. Quote, Islam is presented as a self-consciously monotheistic religion that nevertheless emphasized the action of the sensual world upon the emotions, thus bringing it closer to pagan polytheism. And Schlegel saw in Islam's garden-like paradise the vestiges of heathenism. These judgments on Islam's theology of nature in some ways continued medieval Christian criticisms. The Renaissance, too, had not been terribly interested in virgin nature. Islam here is, to use the old category, essentially Semitic, reverting substantially to Hebrew ideas of the indicativity of nature and the value of the body and of its natural functions in the spiritual life. Hence, celibacy has seldom been celebrated as a virtue among Muslims. Muslims here, as quite often, agree with Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, where he says, Judaism rehabilitates the flesh, attaching the quality of divine image to the biological forces in man. It affirms the goodness of the whole of man, of the natural. And the American Muslim writer Noor al-Jarahi even says, physiology is theology, recalling, I think, the Ghazalian idea of prophetic compliance as the creation of a harmonious human body subject maximally open to divine effulgence. Nature itself is the ship of salvation. It is not the storm which we hope to survive. We might say then that the son who refuses to board the ark, thus denying the Khilafah principle and whose defiance and ignorance is recorded in Surah Hud, is the principle of Cain, murderer of Abel, or perhaps the Neolithic over the Paleolithic, the writer who scorns memorization, the divider of the sensory from the suprasensory, and ultimately the technologist who, as Heidegger depressingly observed, blankets the garden world in greyness and makes of it a wasteland. It is the appearance of images, the belief in a linear time in which God can appear because he had somehow been absent. It is the intercalatory month. It is the replacement of the organic with steel and glass, and with a similar corrosion of the human soul, leading in our time not only to the environmental collapse which defines our so-called Anthropocene age, but to the biopause, the self-sterilization of modern elites, whose birth rates and reproductive capacities are steadily and apparently terminally declining. The Quranic phrase may well be applied against this Islamophobic class, inna shani'aka huwa al-abtar. For as one modern commentator explains it, the most noble animals refuse to breed when in captivity. This idea of the full membership of the saint in the natural world is further underlined by the recital's vision of paradise, which is eroticized. Sexuality in this life is understood not only as an invitation to be fruitful and to multiply, but as a proleptic anticipation of the life of the blessed. Again, this drew predictable and fierce condemnation from some medieval Christians, who assumed that the celibacy of the saint was itself a proleptic, a lived anticipation of an asexual heaven. Death then, in a sense, becomes simply a transferal from one garden to another, now a place free of the element of trial. As in Judaism and the primordial religions, there is no doctrine of original sin of the Augustinian type. Shamanism, a characterization intended probably as an insult, was the judgment of many European readers of the Quran in the 18th and 19th century. But other minds of the European Enlightenment, particularly in its romantic literature, rather liked Islam's sacralizing of nature and its teaching about an integrated body subject. This is evident, for instance, in Goethe's poem on the man of praise, the Mohammedsgesang, which describes him as a mountain stream full of life, which brings the pure water of heaven to the land, raising up not only great cities, but also enhancing the fecundity of nature. As he says, later, lower in the valley, where his steps trod, flowers bloom, and the green meadow has been given life by his breath. Goethe, in his no doubt insufficient and very partial reading of the Quran and Muslim poetry, had been attracted to the biophiliac and world-affirming aspect of the prophetic charism, and the poem enjoyed a certain traction, being set twice to music by Schubert, for instance. But to return to the Muslim scriptures, the idea of the man of praise as an emblem of the life force springs over into a range of hadith which record his encouragement of planting trees and other plants. For instance, this hadith narrated in the collection of Muslim Ibn al-Hajjaj. Never does a Muslim plant a plant or sow a seed so that a bird or a man or an animal eats from it, but that it shall be recorded as a charity for him. And a famous eschatological hadith, if one of you is planting something and the day of judgment begins, finish planting it. So the prophet's color is green, his turban, the dome over his grave, his city is the verdant oasis of Medina. One can imagine the ark as ship of salvation, Safinat al-Najat, flying a green ensign, a banner of praise, anticipating his famous role as life-giving standard-bearer of divine mercy and revivification at the judgment. So focused on the animated quality of the natural order is the recital that we even find passages about insects, notably the Quranic tale of Solomon, who diverted his magnificent army at the request of the queen of the ants, who wanted to protect her anthill from trampling. And in another surah, this is 16, verse 69, your Lord has granted revelation to the bee. Make your home in the mountains and on the trees and the trellises which they erect. Then eat from every fruit and follow humbly the ways of your Lord. And other ayat could be cited, building this Safinat al-Najat. Evidently, the recital of the final Abrahamic replenishment sets out to sacralize biodiversity. Virgin nature is our most proper habitat in this primordialist and naturalist vision, which sees the ship of faith as onboarding nature. The animals sail with us, we preserve them, they have the right to this, almost as though in this world the Khilafah principle of human shepherding and custodianship delivers a sort of saving grace to the animals as well. However, this is not, as in the vision of the moderns, the localized and rather desperate conservation of endangered species in parks and zoos, concentration camps for animal survivors removed from their habitats by materialism's lust for Lebensraum, What is saved is implicitly creation itself in its natural and balanced plenitude. Khilafah entails the preservation not of examples of what humanity has almost destroyed, but of the mizan, the biophiliac balance itself. It is a ship of life, conserving the stupendous miracle of the double helix, which is the matrix for consciousness and hence for the consummation of the divine purpose. All this, for Muslims, is going to confirm the idea of Islam as the religion of milk, of unfallen nature, to be joined through the movements of worship which emphasize our proper belongingness in the world. As in most primordial communities, the direction of prayer is horizontal, not vertical. Time is lunar and not solar. There is no intercalation. And we exercise our innate ability to recognize holiness when living properly in our bodies, recognizing the nature and sanctity of non-human persons and the entire natural world. Again, this reveals modernity as an exercise in alienation. As Leila Abdurrahim writes, a function of civilization is to stamp out our yearning for wildness. Children are born wild and dream of a wild world that exists for its own mystery. The sunnah, then, the Islamic instantiation of primordial living, functions as a shield against the alienation imposed by technical modernity. To follow its norms is to wear a kind of hazmat suit, which shuts out the chemical toxins of a disrupted world. In its insistence on natural living and moderation, it does not only preserve its adherence from many entailments of the toxic world of secular consumption, but even more importantly, from the diseased attitudes which have initiated it. The Sunnah, by allowing us to live in accordance with how things are, is an ark of salvation. In a text which many Muslim eco-warriors like to cite, the Quran says this. This is Surah 30, verse 41. Corruption has appeared on earth and in the sea because of what the hands of men have wrought. Thus does God make them taste some of the consequences of their actions so that they might perhaps return. By adopting the sunnah, by boarding the sunnah, if you like, we find ourselves shielded from the worst poisons of a necrophiliac modernity. We connect again with the motions of sun and moon. We celebrate the sanctity of nature. We fast. We venerate holy places. We repeat an oracular chant whose origin was received in the Jalal, the mysterium tremendum which made its holy recipient sweat and shake. We understand and honor gender. We live for a transcendent purpose, and that form of life is all-embracing. The sunnah ark is not for boarding part-time. This din al-fitra is not a leisure activity, and we do not recognize a spurious dualistic division between sacred and profane any more than our Paleolithic ancestors did. Perhaps one of the most striking demonstrations of this saving primordiality of the Quranic voice is its insistence that we are in community with non-human orders of creation, fellow travelers on this ship, which are also considered to be sentient communities. One of the paleoanthropological criteria for distinguishing the Paleolithic from the Neolithic is that the former created a self which was defined by coordination with nature and other humans, whereas the Neolithic self, we learn, defined itself in relationality with other humans. And here we face something that does seem strangely reminiscent of shamanism. In particular, I would like to focus on one verse which appears in Surah Al-An'am, which is, of course, the Surah of the Cattle, Ayah 38. Here is a possible translation. There is not an animal in the earth nor a bird flying on two wings, but that they are nations like yourselves. We have neglected nothing in the book. Then unto their Lord they will be gathered. Passages such as this obviously form part of the recital's condemnation of Arab pagans who had long defined their tribal identity in terms of animal totems. The man of praise himself had been born into the clan of the shark, Quraysh. As part of its function of delineating tribal identities, paganism had maintained elaborate rituals of animal mutilation and other animal-linked practices which the new ship of salvation viewed as abominations. And this chapter of Al-An'am receives its name because it deals with various such sacrificial and votive rites. In place of a universe directed by tribal deities in which humanity was divided by totems and fetishes, the new monotheism preached a fellowship of believers which was summoned to see the animal order as a sign of creation's unity and integrity under the one God, with the right to share in the salvation from the deluge offered by Noah. The ayah, this remarkable verse in Al-An'am, seems straightforward in its affirmation of animal and bird life, our fellow passengers, presented and valued as sentient orders of creation. And yet it triggered centuries of quite difficult and complex debate. Two themes proved especially taxing for the commentators: the citing of animals as nations like yourselves, umamun amthalukum, and the gathering of animals unto their Lord. In what sense, later authors of tafsir commentaries wondered, could animal communities be like us? And is it true that, like their human counterparts, they will be resurrected to face God's final judgment? Is the ark delivering them with us in that sense? The modern Tunisian theologian and commentator Ibn Ashur laments that, as he says, this is a verse which begins obscurely and ends more obscurely still. The Quran's initial targeting of indigenous Arab religion quickly took on wider implications as part of the continuum of late antique debates over the implications of monotheism for attitudes to the world. The markedly upbeat, affective élan of the Quranic revelation reflected the text's own self-understanding as a historic reparation, as it says, a shifa, a healing, not only of paganism, but, as it asserted, of the religions of the book. When the new recital burst into the former provinces of Christian Byzantium, it was widely received by its audience as a synthetic corrective, repairing, as Muslims saw it, the penitential and severely ascetical temper of early Christianity, and pushing the dominant monotheistic style back in a generally Semitic direction, albeit in an axial mode which could not accommodate the principle of a chosen people. In a Mediterranean world where a pessimism about the world and the body had become normal among Christians who had inherited many of the world and body denying assumptions of late Hellenistic religion, the Ishmaelite ark saw itself as sailing in with an unmistakably life-affirming, though hardly indulgent, worldview, the purpose of the ship being precisely to conserve reproduction, and therefore life, among the human and non-human orders of the biosphere. Its anthropology repudiated the usual patristic teachings on original sin and encouraged a pious style of travelling to God through the world rather than reaching him by creeping around its edges. The new scriptures' ceaseless and repeated conjurations with the material universe as a palette of signs pointing to God and brimming with his imminent qualities stood at the heart of Muslim styles of contemplation in a new and noticeably more positive dispensation, which was unmistakably pro-nature and lyrically celebratory of the natural order. The poetry of Islam, with its typically ecstatic invocation of love, focusing on nature, humans, rose garden, the divine beloved, was the natural voicing of this new biophiliac culture. It's perhaps due to this twofold Quranic challenge to Arabian and ancient Christian views of the natural world that we find the early Muslim scribes keen to record a very large bulk of prophetic directives on welfare, how to treat our fellow passengers. These have been investigated in a recent book by Richard Foltz, a text alert to the vast improvement, as he sees it, brought to territories by the arrival of this new and reparative dispensation. Foltz even goes so far as to conclude that, quote, the mainstream Islamic legal tradition accords more rights to non-human animals than do the legal systems of the contemporary West. Quite a polemical statement, but one which he believes is supported by the witness of the classical Sharia texts and the pro-nature vision of the new sealing revelation with its retrieval of the fitra principle of primordiality. The founder, as a man exampling what Blackhurst identifies as Islam's distinct blend of a primordial sense of appurtenance to nature with an extremely uncompromising and simple monotheism, seems to have dispensed a good fraction of his moral teaching with reference to the animal kingdom. Some of his sayings are evidently attacks on pagan practices, as in the hadith where he says, "May God curse anyone who maims animals." But the larger genre indicates a more general insistence on ethical treatment of the animal order, which are symbolically protected by his ark, the Sunnah ark. Some examples, hadith. "It is a great sin for a man to imprison the animals which are in his power." Again, "A dog was once panting by a well, almost dead with thirst. Beholding it, a harlot of the children of Israel removed her slipper, dipped it in the water, and gave it to drink. For this, God forgave her her sins." Another hadith. "We were once on a journey with Allah's messenger, who left us for a short while. We saw a humara bird with two young, and he took the two young fledglings. The humara hovered with fluttering wings, and the prophet returned, saying, 'Who has injured this bird by taking its young? Return them to her.' The prophet forbade that animals should be set to fight each other." In some cases, we find the man of praise challenging the culture of hunting which had existed in Arabia from time immemorial. While hunting game for food is still permitted, sport hunting is to be forbidden. Hadith, "There is no one that without reason kills a sparrow or anything higher thereto, but that God shall ask him about it." Hadith, "The prophet cursed anyone who took an animate creature as a target." So I guess no bullfighting. Such texts have a straightforward moral and hortatory purpose, emphasizing the essential goodness and worth of our fellow passengers, the evidencing of which is to be a particular theme of the final stage in the Abrahamic story. More curious are the hadiths which seem to invest animals around the founder with a near-human degree of consciousness. And it's here that the tafsir author's puzzlement over our verse originates, and we find perhaps some sort of explanation for the Enlightenment descriptions of Islam as shamanistic. What are we to make, for instance, of the following tale narrated in Abu Dawood's collection of hadiths? The hadith has the man of praise going into a farm where a camel is experiencing a fit of groaning with its eyes streaming. The prophet, unafraid, walks over to it and rubs its ears and it quietens down. He asks who the camel belongs to, and a man identifies himself as its owner. The prophet says, "Do you not fear God concerning this beast which he has let you own? It complained to me that you starve it and tire it by overworking it and using it beyond its capacity." In the same hagiographies, we find that key instances in the founder's career depend on animals for their successful outcome, and that these animals, our fellow passengers, are presented as recipients of some kind of divine inspiration. Perhaps the best-known example is the founder's choice of a site for his home and mosque when he arrived as a refugee in Medina. Seeing that rival clans wished to have the political advantage of having him as their guest, to preclude disputes, he let go of the reins of his camel and said that Providence would guide it to the correct place. The site the camel chose is now, of course, the location of his mosque and his grave. In another very famous incident, the Abyssinian Christian army, which had come to destroy the Kaaba, is confounded by two animal interventions. Firstly, its fearsome battle elephant refuses to march on the holy city. And secondly, the invading army is pelted with stones by birds. A no less celebrated case is the rescue of the man of praise from pagan pursuers during his exodus to Medina. As he hides in a cave, pigeons make a nest and a spider weaves a web over the cave entrance, a miracle which served to persuade the search party that, of course, nobody could have entered the cave for days. These are stories known to every Muslim child. In these hadiths, which show the man of praise and his city saved by the intervention of animals, one is struck by the fact that these creatures are presented as consciously acting under divine tuition. This seems rather strange, anomalous, in a religious culture which was in full revolt against a pagan animism in which desert creatures, even trees and rocks, had been reckoned to contain spirits, jinn of various kinds. kind of generalization about the rationalizing shift from polytheism to monotheism would presume that ancient superstitions about souls inhabiting the natural world would be vigorously suppressed in favor of a belief in divine and human monopoly of consciousness and agency. But in the primal Islamic case, the prophetic age, something much more complex seems to have emerged. Again, we seem to revert to our characterization of the Ishmaelite religion as a reprise of really very ancient, even primordial styles of sacrality, coupled, of course, nonetheless, with a fierce rejection of any hint of polytheistic belief. The Muslim tradition itself promotes this self-understanding. The Meccan shrine is claimed to have been the worshipping place of Adam, long predating the Jerusalem temple. Islam, taking itself to be the final moment in the monotheistic drama, also claims to be a significant rehabilitation and invocation of pre-Abrahamic forms of worship and relationship with the world. It is thus that the mediator sage who can communicate with animals bears a book which instructs its audience to consider them as nations like unto yourselves. Having very briefly sketched Islam's self-understanding as the ship of salvation, which entails particularly a recovery of a biophiliac and really ancient primordial religious style, let's now go on to survey the tafsir literature on our chosen Quranic crux, which seems to deepen the Noah story so indicatively. Here's the verse again. There is not an animal in the earth nor a bird flying on two wings, but that they are nations like yourselves. We have neglected nothing in the book, then unto their Lord they will be gathered. Firstly, we have to consider the puzzle represented by animal nations. Fellow passengers are nations. The word is umam, the plural of ummah, the familiar Arabic word which almost invariably applies to human collectivities. Muslims themselves, of course, constitute an ummah. In arguing against pagan cruelty, scripture here appears rhetorical in suggesting that birds and animals form communities. They are peoples, they are non-human peoples. But the rhetoric does not invalidate the comparison, and the commentators needed to determine exactly what kind of nations these animal passengers form. The preferred view was that each species was an ummah. So Fakhruddin Razi, for instance, dies 1209, produces a hadith in which the Prophet describes dogs as comprising an ummah. More tricky is the question of how these species might be like ourselves, amthalukum. The tafsir commentaries offer the following possible interpretations. Number one, nations indicates that their members resemble each other, can reproduce with each other, and find comfort, uns, in each other. Interpretation number two, they are like humans in that they are also created by Allah and depend on His provision. Three, they are like us and unlike the inanimate realm in being capable of mutual communication. Four, they are like us insofar as they are reached by God's grace, care, mercy, and compassion. Five, they resemble us in being resurrected to receive their rights, huquq. We're going to take a look at this startling claim a bit later on. Number six, each species is an ummah inasmuch as it prefigures some set of human potentialities. So some humans are a bit like dogs, others are like peacocks or lions and so forth. It's another interpretation in the tafsir literature. You can see that they're kind of struggling with this text. So these views are certainly all present as possible views in Razi's huge commentary. And others appear elsewhere. For instance, Al-Qurtubi, who dies in 1273, thinks that animals are like ourselves in that it is not right for humans to wrong them. That's what he says, thus indicating that the word ummah specifically denotes a community possessed of rights. It's a kind of legal definition. There is evidence that the founder's companions cited this verse in order to urge kindness to animals. That's the basis for Qurtubi's view. So these interpretations are really very disparate, but they all share an essentially ethical conclusion. Whatever its exact sense, the verse clearly enjoins us to behave morally towards these orders of creation which ride the ark along with us, because God has deliberately stated that they bear a valid resemblance to our human selves. They segue into a second set of interpretations, which one might call cosmological. Razi cites the companion Ibn Abbas as holding that these communities are like ourselves, quote, because they know God, attest to his unity, and praise and glorify him, end quote. This he links to the text of the recital, which we mentioned a few minutes ago. There is nothing that does not hymn his praise. And also a verse about living creatures, each of which knows its form of prayer and worship. Salat, tasbih, usual commonplace words that Muslims apply to their own devotions. God himself and his messengers have spoken to non-human animals, like the ant, the bee, the famous story of the Hudhud. Hence, the animals may be seen as somehow possessing a form of consciousness which may be used to promote God's purposes. Here we return to the strange, curious crypto-animism or anthropomorphism which some have claimed and which we discussed earlier. Razi cites a hadith in which we learn, whoever kills a sparrow in jest, it will come on the day of judgment, chirruping to God, saying, O Lord, this man killed me in jest and took no benefit from me and did not leave me to eat the fruits of the earth. Illuminated in this way by an actually very large number of prophetic homilies, the verse becomes a key crux for Muslim debates over animal consciousness and animal souls. The Sufi tradition in particular, with its ecstatic focus on the Quran's mystical vision of all creation, witnessing to God in its own distinctive way, picked it up to produce some very lyrical outpourings. Here, for instance, is one of the great Persian Sufis, Rusbehan Bakhli, who dies in 1209, in his tafsir, which is called Ara'is al-Bayan. God created the animals, birds, predators, and insects with a primordial nature, fitra, of monotheism and instinctual knowledge of him, which is why he speaks to them and has created for their minds pathways to his eternal presence and secrets. It is by that presence that they live. Their whistling, lowing, singing, and roaring are from the sweetness of the spiritual world which is reaching them and the manifest lights of his glory. They long lovingly for God and to taste the oceans of his mercy. Rusbehan then supplies some Sufi stories. The mystic Somnoon was once preaching on love, and a bird which had been listening ecstatically fell from the sky and died in front of him. He also gives us a legend about a lizard that recited a poem before the prophet in his praise. For Rusbehan, nations like yourselves means like humanity in seeking the true God and in intuiting him from his subtleties in creation, which bring out the lights of his attributes in the world. Interestingly, the animals are seen not just as passive substrates for the divine properties, but as active pursuers and agents of his truth. So again, what is the meaning of like unto ourselves? Here he tries to explain, quote, all the nations share a basic created nature in being composed of the four elements and are made with animal and spiritual natures and are equal in eating and drinking, motion and congregation, the qualities of the self and properties of identity, such as desire, anger, passion, and pride. This equality, tasawi, is based in the stuff of the primordial nature according to which God has made them. As he has said, from it did we create you, to it do we return you, and from it we shall bring you forth one more time. Surah 20, verse 55. They all have their drinking places, says Rusbehan, in the ocean of God's speech and his eternal words, which indicate the paths of his unity. The nature of animals, birds and insects and predators is mingled with knowledge of their maker and creator, whose qualities and essence they know. This discourse is not difficult or insufficient for them to understand. This leads naturally to the second of the great puzzles thrown up by the verse. Are the animals really to be resurrected, as the text seems to indicate? And if so, does this strengthen the case that they are to be judged and are hence not only sentient beings, but moral ones as well? Do they travel in the ark with us to salvation? The verse ends with the prediction that all will be gathered to their Lord. This appears to be underlined by another Quranic text, and when the wild beast shall be ingathered, وَإِذَا الْوُحُوشُ حُشِرَتْ, which is to be a sign of the cataclysmic last judgment. The concept in both verses is that of Hashr, which is a perfectly normal Quranic designation for the resurrection at the end of time. Some commentators balked at the picture of the resurrection of all animals for judgment and proposed that resurrection, Hashr here, simply meant that all animals will be united in death. They're gathered to death, not to resurrection. And there were companions who could be cited in support of this view. However, such attempts really to defuse the plain sense of the verse were confounded by a cluster of perfectly respectable hadith whose concern was to emphasize the plenitude of God's justice and which brought animals undeniably onto the eschatological stage. Here's one of these texts. On the day of arising, all of creation will be gathered together, the cattle, the riding beasts, the birds, and every other thing, and it shall be by God's justice that he takes the hornless sheep's case against the horned one. Then he shall say, be dust. The concern of these hadiths is to show that animals are incorporated within God's structures of justice. So another well-known hadith describes the man of praise seeing two sheep fighting each other. He asks his companion, Abu Dharr, if he knew why they were fighting. But when Abu Dharr confessed that he had no idea, he replied, but God knows and shall judge between them on the day of resurrection. So clearly here we confront the second of Ibn Ashur's obscurities. There was really no deep problem with the idea that God would show justice to the animals which ride with us, the Ark of Wholeness. But on closer consideration, the exact nature of their accountability seemed extremely taxing. The early Mu'tazilite movement, eventually dismissed as schismatic, had included the doctrine that a perfectly just God was obliged to put right all animal suffering at the end of time by providing heavenly compensation. The vision of a heaven filled with every animal and insect that had ever lived was not widely appealing. Would even vermin be found in the heavenly abode, fleas, cockroaches in paradise? Mainstream orthodoxy denied, in any case, that God could be subject to any obligation. He will quicken dead animals not because he has to, but from his free fiat and glory. Moreover, the Orthodox reasoned that a God obligated to impose strict justice on animals would also have to send some of them to hell, and this was widely agreed to be unlikely. Some Mu'tazilites also held that animals would be in heaven forever. After all, if God killed them, then his justice would oblige him to compensate them for that, which would be impossible, since they would no longer exist. Considering these paradoxes, the mainstream thinkers concluded that after the animals had experienced full recompense, God would painlessly turn them to dust. But many Orthodox writers like the idea that at least some animals will be received into heaven. Mawardi, for instance, says that in paradise, the believers will enjoy riding them and looking at them. So divine recompense of some sort for animal suffering is thus generally accepted by normative Islam. So the deliverance of the animals is not just so that they can provide usufruct after the waters of the deluge have subsided, but because they are communities that have a right to survive as we do. But what about the reward for moral conduct? As we've seen, writers of the stamp of Ruzbehan thought that animal consciousness, as detected by the saints, is so human-like that animals receive prophets and moral codes. And these writers could easily appeal to the hadith. The sheep fighting each other will have their dispute resolved, presumably through God punishing the culpable party. But the more exoteric authorities attribute a rather vague kind of lesser morality to them. As Qurtubi said, the pen does not move for them, but they will still be taken to task, the pen being the divine record of virtuous and vicious acts. For the theologians, animals are not mukallaf, not subject to full moral accountability, as humans are. They note that there are other entities, such as the mad or children, who will be resurrected, but are insufficiently morally accountable and are hence not mukallaf. Not every mind that faces eternity in heaven is fully competent. Further insight is supplied by Ibn Ashur, who cites the Sicilian jurist Al-Mazuri who dies in 1141, who taught that the resurrection and recompense of the animals exist to show mankind God's perfect justice. Thinking legally, Masary continues by observing that the verse requires believers to be kind to animals because the animals have rights, huquq. If animal resurrection and the restoration of their rights at that time applies to animal-on-animal injustice, then it's even more appropriate that animals should be recompensed for wrongs visited upon them by human beings. Here, Ibn Ashur cites the well-known hadith which describes a woman who went to hell for starving her cat to death. So in this context, classical Islamic law accepts that animals, our fellow passengers, possess rights. While animal rights are treated in a rather scattered way in the legal manuals, the following definition by one of the leading jurists, Al-Iz bin Abd as-Salam, who dies in 1262, may be taken as normative. This is what he says. These are the rights over man which are vested in animals. Man must spend on them appropriately, even on animals which are old or sick and are no longer of benefit. An animal has the right not to be burdened beyond its capacity. It must not be placed in the same enclosure as any animal which would harm it by breaking its bones, wounding it, or goring it. That's in his, for those who know about these things, his book Qawa'id al-Ahkam fi Masalih al-Anam. And he adds some further rights, including the right to access animals of the opposite gender. That's a right. Of course, the jurists also permit animals to be slaughtered for food, but this is strictly on the grounds of a divine permission, which is invoked at the moment of slaughter. To eat an animal killed without such a blessing is to commit the sin of eating carrion. The permission exists not because it reflects the purpose of the animal's creation, but simply because of divine fiat, which confirms the human species in its place in the food chain, if you like, the natural order. And so Ibn Abd as-Salam adds to his list of animal rights the right to a good death. So it's time to try and find my way to a conclusion. The symbolism of the prophetic ascension indicates rather clearly that the mediatic function of Islam as disclosive of the ontological togetherness of heaven and earth, soul and flesh, inaugurates a new prophetic age which, while universal and non-tribal, requires its adherents to adopt a pattern of life and a theology of immanence which emphasize our entire belongingness to the biological order. Understanding this is precisely to board the Safinat al-Najat, the Ark of Salvation. It seems that the will of Providence for this last Abrahamic replenishment is that Islam as Din al-Fitra will be both axial and primordial. This is our image of the Sunnah as a hazmat suit needful in a time of pestilence, a sane and visionary centering amid what Nur al-Jarahi calls the modern circus of the blind. Hence, followers of the man of praise are charged with a universal khilafah. Nature belongs on Noah's ark because Noah belongs to nature. By divine gift, the forms of worship on board this vessel are intact. To enter into a mosque, itself an emblem of the Ark, is to be comforted and uplifted by an authentic memory of sacred history's culminating event, which ushers in a final age in which the ancient human awareness of the sentience and praise of all creation is recovered as a precious sign to those who need metaphysical, not only physical reasons, to fight for the animals and trees. The ego, like Noah's son, is of us, but at the same time is not what we are. It is familiar, but alien. It is the part of us which must be left behind. The archetype of intercession, Noah's pleading with God to save his son, recalls the fuller and more universal, more successful scope of the banner of praise and the praiseworthy station. And yet the ego is not willing to approach the ship. Innahu laysa min ahlik. Ignorance and drowning in the deluge, ghariq bahr al-isyan, remains a possibility intrinsic in the mystery of human freedom.